Well, that intro music sounded a little bit like Shades of Doc Severinsen, if you're familiar with that name. Welcome to the Mead House here on Tuesday night. Jeff Chouse in the house. And it sounded like he just got done cleaning out his garage, but I think things have finally quieted down in his neck of the woods. Aaron Martin in the house. We're going to talk about a conversation that he had that he and I had for about an hour and a half about beer the other night. And, of course, Mississippi Chris, he's on days off, so the pager is turned off, and he'll be with us the whole night. So my name is J.D. Webb, and again, welcome to the Mead House. We got a pretty packed show tonight. We're expecting a call from one of our listeners, Brian, here in just a little bit. I didn't get around to all the Facebook things, and so I apologize to our listeners if you don't hear your name mentioned. I promise I'll get to that next week. But we always try to start the show off with a little bit of alcoholic libation or otherwise. Let's start off with Chris tonight. Don't tell me it's coffee.
Well, you know we always catch me at supper time, so that's what I'm doing now.
that after-dinner coffee? I like that too.
No, I'm actually eating dinner, and I'm eating in my chair tonight. So I'm at the age now where I have a favorite chair.
Yeah.
And so everybody, I guess, they always laugh because of what I'm eating. But tonight, in case you're curious, it's tacos and of course my southern glass of tea.
Sweet tea.
Yep.
All right, tacos and sweet tea. That sounds pretty good. Aaron Martin in the house. What's in your glass tonight, my friend?
Well, it's funny. It's taco night at the Martin household as well.
Wow. Okay, now wait a minute. All right, now you and Chris, like, you're doing this like offline thing. What's going on here?
We are. We're conspiring here to. next week it's going to be some beef brisket, right, Chris?
Oh wow!
I'm always up for beef brisket.
There you go.
What are you drinking, Aaron?
Tonight I am drinking a Fox Hill Meadery Mead. This is the meadery I visited down in near Asheville, North Carolina. This is their ginger apricot mead, and just a really delicious brew that they put together here. Pretty strong ginger flavor going on. This is one that I would definitely recommend drinking more at room temperature. Initially had the bottle chilled and not sure that was the best way to go here, but all in all, a pretty solid mead here from Fox Hill.
Can you taste the apricot at all?
You know, it's in there. I think the dominant flavor is definitely the ginger, and you really have to search for the apricot. It's in there kind of next to the honey flavor. So yes, but you definitely kind of have to work to get the apricot.
I've heard, I've read that apricot, like peach or some candy, sometimes can be a difficult fruit to work with when making a melomel, making a mead. I don't know how true that is, but I've been a little fearful of you know, because I love apricots.
Oh, yeah.
And I would love to put an apricot mead together, and maybe I'll try to tackle that. But sounds good, Aaron. Jeff, what's in the glass?
So on the topic of apricot mead, I actually have 3.5 pounds of apricots in my freezer waiting to go into a mead. I'm pretty sure they're going to be a really light flavor, but oh my gosh, am I looking forward to that. Yeah. I've actually done a fruit and spice mead with honeybush tea and a little bit of dried apricot. And the apricot was nice, but the nice part about using the dried apricot as opposed to like fresh apricot is that over time that kind of developed a little bit more and it bloomed, especially in the aroma. So I might finish it on a little bit of dried apricot too.
Yeah, go ahead. I didn't mean
to. I was just going to say it'll be a little bit difficult to source. Just because I know that a lot of the dried fruits like apricot tend to be kind of they tend to be coated in a little bit of oil, which makes it a better preserved product. But oil can go rancid in the mead, and I wouldn't want to do that.
I was just, so. We're thinking on the same lines here. I was just going to mention that I've looked around the store and lots of dried, prepackaged dried fruits. Take your pick. But, when you turn the package over and start reading, the ingredients, looking for that telltale sign of any kind of preservative, here's this coconut oil or whatever kind of oil that they're greased up with to make them look shiny and new, right, and fresh, can't use that. So,
and it seems like a lot of the stuff that doesn't have the oil coating is instead coated with like a really, really sugary and kind of citric acidy glaze that they dip it in before they dry it too. So, that can really screw up your chemistry too. There's just no winning with most of it. I got some of this, I think, I can't even remember where I got it. I would have to go through my notes and see if I even remember the guy I bought it from. But it was probably a farmer's market somewhere and it came out okay. I used a scant amount, maybe a couple grams of it at best. But the flavor was enough to come through. I think I bloomed it in some hot water before I added it in there.
Yeah. Sounds good.
So well, anyway, what I was drinking.
So what you're drinking is,
I have a California Common that I made, in the vein of Anchor Steam, if you guys are familiar with that one.
Oh yeah, yep.
Really malty, it has a nice bit of carbonation to it, and really enjoyable.
Yeah, good stuff. I'm drinking my own beer, my first beer. And I'm rather proud of this. Now, this is a pumpkin beer. It's a kit beer that I got from More Beer Extract and some specialty grains and some pumpkin spices that I replaced with my own. I got some fresh spices and put my own in, but I went with the same amount that had been sent in the package. I don't know that was enough. It was like 2 teaspoons. I think I would probably put maybe a tablespoon in next time. And I also add, because I checked all my sources, even all of the reviews that associated with this brew, and people were commenting about how they added roasted pumpkin, canned pumpkin, and whatnot. So I chucked in 3 15-ounce cans of organic, pure pumpkin puree at the 15-minute mark, 15 minutes to go on the boil. And I'm expecting this pumpkin, this almost like a pumpkin pie flavor is what I'm looking for. Well, I didn't get that. And I'm convinced that although the beer tastes good, I can't taste one bit of pumpkin at all. None. And I have to go back to, I taste everything. I have to go back to when I opened the can of pumpkin and I took a spoonful of it and put it in my mouth. You might as well chew on an old sock because it doesn't taste like anything. I mean, it just tastes like cold, dead squash. So I'm not so sure. I'm not convinced yet the pumpkin is really good in anything. I don't know that, I haven't had a good quote-unquote pumpkin mead or wine or anything like that, and I've had various pumpkin beers. So I think possibly the next time I make this, I just might leave the pumpkin completely out and just go with the spices and see what kind of a difference, you know, that it does present. Now, I got to say that I believe the three cans of pumpkin added this kind of a very slight creaminess to the taste. I think that's coming from the pumpkin, but I couldn't tell you for sure. This is my first first ever, you know, beer, you know, made at home. So, but I am pleased with it. So, you know, a little bit more carbonation, I think. I don't know how to get around that. It was 4 ounces of priming sugar, you know, when we bottled it, you know, that was with, you know, came with the kit and everything. So, I don't know, is more priming sugar make more carbonation? I don't know. Aaron, Jeff?
Well, yeah, generally. The more priming sugar you have, the more carbonation you can work into it. I mean, there are calculators online to help you figure out, like, the style of beer, the amount of CO2 pressure you want at the end, and how much of each variety of priming sugar you could add to get to that point.
Yeah.
JD, well, was that a 5 gallon batch you did?
Yep. Oh yeah, everything I do is 5 gallons. Yeah.
Everything, and you said you used 4 ounces of priming sugar.
Yep, that's what came with the kit. And, okay.
Interesting. So, I think I usually use 16 ounces of priming sugar.
16?
No. I'm sorry, 3/4 cup.
That's about four to five ounces, I think.
Okay, I'm sorry. I was looking at the water. It's 16 ounces of water.
I was going to say that's a lot of sugar.
I think the kits I've done have came with about 5 ounces, give or take.
You know, I could see adding another ounce, you know, to help the carbonation out. I mean, it's carbonated, but just not quite enough. Again, welcome to the Mead House. We do have a phone number if you have the inclination to give us a holler, 818-921-4680. Our website, The Mead House, themeadhouse.com. You can go there and listen to the show. You can also get us on TuneIn Radio. TuneIn does have the apps. We're mobile. You can take us with you. And the Facebook, real simple, The Mead House. That's how simple it is. So with that out of the way, we're waiting on a call from Brian, one of our listeners. He emailed us and had a number of questions that he wanted to talk about tonight. And I told him, absolutely, be more than happy to help him out. So while we're waiting for him to call, let's go over to Chris. And, you know, we've put a couple of recipes together on the show already. One was the Orange Blossom Special. Both of these recipes are up on the website. Chris, where are we with the Orange Blossom? We should be, what, drinking it by now?
We should be drinking by now, absolutely. Should be definitely ready to bottle as long as it's clear.
Yeah.
And if it's not cleared by now, you probably should consider degassing it and using some sort of fining agent.
Yeah, like super clear or something along those lines.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. And the cherry, did you ever give that a name, or did we just call it cherry mead?
I guess it's the cherry experiment. Just doing some different things to it. Right now we're sitting in secondary on Malib and the Dutch processed cocoa. And we've been on it, if I'm not mistaken, this is week 4. And after a quick taste, I think I'm going to leave it on for one more week before I rack it off into tertiary and let it start clearing.
Now there's, you know,
that's something that each person needs to do at this point, however, because we had a little leeway in this thing with a starting gravity, and so you know, you should be tasting along, and if it's where you think it should be, go ahead and rack it when you think it's right.
Now, for people who, you know, aren't aware, we've mentioned Mollub a couple of times. Can you tell us again what exactly Mollub is, if people are just now hearing that term, that word?
Mollub is a denatured cherry pit that has been dried, and it's gone through a process to have the poisons removed.
And you can get them from where?
You can get them at most Middle Eastern spice stores if you have a Middle Eastern grocery. If you not, if you don't, you can go online to places like Penzies, places like worldspice.com. There's any number of online spice food suppliers will have it. You may see them in three different forms. You may see them whole, crushed, or ground, and it really doesn't matter which one you use. I usually get the whole ones and just put them in a bag and take a meat mallet or a hammer or something and crush them up coarsely. They don't have to be ground up fine.
Okay.
And they add a little bit of I don't know if you would describe it as bready, but it's a little bit of a cherry pie. It's reminiscent of cherry pie, and the only thing that I can think of is that it's maybe given a hint of having like the crusty flavor from a pie, so it's really hard to describe, but it adds something that's really interesting to a cherry mead. So that's what we're going with.
Well, and who doesn't like cherry pie? I mean, you know.
Yeah, really. and the chocolate, like I said, don't expect this is not like eating a Hershey bar. But the chocolate just adds it adds another layer of flavor that blends well with the cherry. It won't be very prominent, but it will be present.
Well, chocolate kind of goes with a lot of things anyway, so it made sense to put a cherry mead. So
it's sort of one of those things where you don't really notice it that much when it's there, but if it wasn't there, you could definitely tell the difference.
Yeah. Very good.
I'm going another week with mine, and each person will have to taste it and decide. I will go ahead and say, though, when you get ready to rack this thing, you're probably going to have some oil floating on top from the cocoa. And if that's the case, just try to keep your racking cane below it, and don't let that oil get sucked into your racking cane.
Yeah. Yeah, good point. Is there anything that, is that something you just can't avoid?
It's just one of those things. It's part of cocoa, and the oils are going to be there, and some powders are going to have more than others, but... it's okay. Just rack below it. You know, keep your racking cane below that, and don't try to get so much meat out that you start getting sediment and oil. Just rack out what you can, good clear meat, and then top up.
Yeah. Okay.
So if you followed the recipe, you should have probably another half gallon at least, if not a gallon, sitting aside to top up with. So.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So another week in a carboy, and then get ready to rack. So by the next show, we should be able to talk about that whole experience, what to look for, and the next process in this cherry mead. So, Brian, I'm assuming that's Brian on the line. Am I right?
Yes. Yeah.
Hey, Brian, welcome to the Mead House.
Thanks for having me.
Brian emailed us and had a couple of questions, and I told him, by all means, give us a holler, and we'll do what we can to help him out. So Brian's on the line with us here tonight. Brian, let's turn it over to you, my friend. What did you have on your mind?
Well, I just first off, I want to tell you I'm pretty jealous of y'all having all your fine drinks tonight. My my cup runneth over with high quality H2O tonight, so
that worked.
That's as full as ready as I can get tonight. Otherwise, the phone will ring and I won't be able to answer it. So yeah.
All right.
No, but I thought it's quite a good time to chime in on this. Y'all talking about where the current recipe is or where your current batch is, and I wanted to kind of touch base on that, where, you know, y'all were talking about using the Firmaid K and the GoFirm and whatnot. And when I started making meat, it's been about a year and a half now, and, you know, the stuff that I read and where I, you know, from Ken Schran's book and other recipes, I kind of went the way of using Firmax and the yeast energizer. And, you know, I've kind of looked at, you know, what's in all of that in both of those and whatnot and compared to it. Have y'all ever used anything but the Firmaid K and the GoFirm? Have y'all used the Firmax?
You know, Brian, I've asked the same question. I have used a generic brand that has come from one of the brew shops here that I have used. I have no idea what's in it. I'm sure it's a repackage from a bulk source that they're using. Jeff, Aaron, Chris?
I have used Firmaid O, Firmaid K, and DAP, and that's it. I have no experience outside of that as far as nutrients are concerned. You know, I am aware that some places do repackage nutrients. The same way they repackage yeast, they'll just repackage something under a different label. So I'm not familiar with Firmax, but I do know Ken Schran knows his stuff. So if he's recommending it, then, you know, don't worry about it. Just give it a go.
Yeah, and that's what I've been doing. And, you know, I read about it, and it's what Firmax, it says it contains the DAP, the dipotassium phosphate, magnesium sulfite, and autolyzed yeast, which sounds, you know, somewhat similar to what's in Firmaid K. There's other stuff in Firmaid K that Firmax doesn't have. So, you know, that's why I was kind of wondering what the differences would be or whatever. But sounds like it's a, you know, just as good as
that. Well, JD and I have already been through this conversation several times, actually, about using Lalamond and Lalvin products, and which Lalvin is a subsidiary of Lalamond. And, you know, it's not because I endorse their products or anything. I don't have any stake in the company. I know they don't pay me to. The fact of the matter is, the few times that I've had problems with a batch, it has been when I used either a different brand yeast or, yeast actually, because I've never used any other nutrients. But the couple of times that I did have some pretty serious problems, it was with a different brand yeast. So I've used Lalvin products ever since I started, and I've never had any problems with those. So I just tend to stick with what works. Now, that's not to say that Firmax, and I don't even know who makes Firmax, by the way, because I'm not familiar with it. But if something's working for you, stick with it.
Isn't that
it just so happens that the Lalvin products work for me, and the Firmaid K and the Firmaid O, those are all products of that company.
Isn't that Cell or something?
I want to say it's BSG or something.
Or yeah, BSG. I think it's BSG, but there's another one out there, Cell or something or other, that also makes another, you know, another type of yeast nutrient. But Jeff, Aaron, preferences? Have you guys used anything other than Lalamond products for Maid?
For me, I'll tell you, I have used just the generic repackaged yeast nutrient and yeast energizer from the local homebrew supply shop, and definitely noticed a pretty significant jump in the quality of my mead when I switched to Fermade O. Now, granted, I think along with that jump came some other changes to my process, you know, closer attention to temperatures, closer attention to pH levels, regular degassing for the first week in primary. So it's difficult to say if that kind of jump forward in quality, you know, how much of that was attributed to the change in nutrients versus some of those other variables that changed as well. But definitely I've had some experience with both the generic, whatever yeast nutrient energizer and the Fermade product. And I've been very satisfied with the Fermade O.
You know,
One of the things that
I find rather curious is everywhere you go, whether you go to GotMead or homebrewtalk.com, winemakingtalk.com, all these places that talk about recipes, you know, for making mead, you know, 99% of the time they're all using the Fermade product, whether it's Fermade O or Fermade K. Yet when I go to the three local homebrew stores that are close to me, there's not one single Fermade product. They've got all the Lallemand, all the Lalvin yeasts, but no Fermade K, no Fermade O in any of them. But Jeff, I know you've used both K and O, right?
Yes. I got started with the same kind of generically labeled yeast nutrient yeast energizers that Aaron was talking about. You pick them at the homebrew store, use those according to label directions, and they worked okay. I switched over to Fermade K a little bit before I tried the big experiment where I was comparing them, and I liked the results, but along with that, like Aaron was talking about, you know, other improvements to my process came along with that, so it's a little bit tough to tell whether it was all due to the nutrient or if it was, you know, more attention to the process as well. I would assume, yeah, more attention to the process as well helped a lot, but yeah, I think they work okay. Like Chris was alluding to, the fact that they have a product that they stand behind and that's consistently good means something to me. That I know that I don't have to. I'm not putting a lot at risk throwing in, a new container of Fermade K. I don't need to, you know, try something out to make sure that it's good this time. There is something to be said importantly for consistency, I think.
I can tell you that, you know, as much research that I've done on this subject, on mead making, I believe that the Fermade products are probably going to be the industry standard when it comes to home mead making. They're the Fermade O and Fermade K are the two most talked about, most discussed in virtually every single forum and everything that I have ever looked at, in home mead making. So that being the case.
Yeah, and I would add also that for in my opinion, you can pretty much do away with the diammonium phosphate, except in some special rare occasions. Extremely, extremely high gravity starts, it may help to put just a touch of DAP in at the very beginning, but that's just my opinion. I've completely done, in fact, I don't even have any DAP, in the house right now, so, focus on your Fermade K and Fermade O. As far as your Fermax that you ask about, if that's something that's working for you, stick with it. But I'd say at least give the other a try and see if you notice any difference. Keep all your other variables the same.
I have to do that because that's what I haven't done yet. I don't know. I've only just done Fermax, so I don't know how it would taste different or if it would, be drinkable sooner or whatnot. So, that's a good point.
you're, well, there's a lot of, there's so many factors. You can't just really pin it on one thing, I don't think. But, you know, each thing is important on its own. So the only way to know is to try and keep things as identical as possible. Of course, if you get different honey, then there you go. You can't really compare. So do like JD, buy a 60-pound pail of honey and make everything out of that one batch.
Well, you mentioned that, and I was catching up on some of the episodes, and one of the episodes y'all talked about some of the, I believe it was you, Aaron, that had the basswood honey, and there was a guy up in Germantown, Wisconsin, that posted on one of these sites, and he had a whole lot of honey he was trying to sell, and so I ordered 5 gallons from him, and I got it sent to me, and I've got a 3-gallon batch of traditional going right now, so we'll see how that turns out.
Oh, nice. I got honey from the same guy.
Oh, yeah. Did you?
It's going to have some character, I can tell you that.
Yeah, when I tasted it, when you described it too, Chris, about how that little bite at the back of your throat, yeah, I can agree with that.
It's got some acidity to it that no other honey has.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, so we'll see how that goes.
And not to go too far off topic, but while we're on the topic of Germantown basswood honey, this past weekend on Friday, actually had some company visiting, and we took the day off of work, went to visit a local apiary in Germantown. Shout out to Indian Summer Honey Farms up in Germantown, Wisconsin. They do free tours, and couldn't have been, you know, nicer hosts and better tour guides. It was just a really fascinating day to see the honey making process and how they extract the honey. But they actually had some fresh, like, honeycomb of basswood honey, and just like right out of the frame, our tour guide actually like cut out a hunk of this basswood honey and gave us each a hunk to chew on. And my goodness, was that delicious! So. Just thought I'd share that since we were on the topic.
Jeff, we've got our own homegrown beekeeper here too. Jeff's going to be given. Well, you already have been given tours of your beehive. Jeff, is he still here?
Sorry, I was on mute. My son was knocking on the door here. Yeah, I've got a couple little videos up on Facebook of some stuff I've been doing with the new queen I put into one of my hives. Yeah.
Brian, you had another question about oaking, oak spirals or something, didn't you?
Yeah, you know, you talked about in one of the episodes how you can, you know, soak them in bourbon or whiskey, whatever you want. But if you don't want to do that and you go buy them at your local homebrew store, you just crack open the package and drop them in, no big deal?
No.
Or you need to treat them some way first.
No, I'll tell you what I do. I'll drop them in a little pan of star sand for a few minutes, get some contact on, pull them out, let them dry, and then I'll put them in.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, I don't, nothing. You know, I mean, Chris and Aaron, I mean, you guys and Jeff chime in here, but I don't put anything inside my product, my mead, my must. Unless it's sanitized, nothing, not even spoons, not utensils, nothing. So, Jeff, Aaron.
See, I think if I remember right, when I was doing the oak spirals, I dunked it in some near boiling water for maybe a minute and a half, 2 minutes. And then I inserted it in there, basically like the same idea, kill all the buggers on it and keep it safe. Get a little hydration in there too.
The Brett bacteria is notorious for growing on oak, so you do want to do something to it. You can dip it in vodka for a couple of minutes, star sand, boiling water, anything. Just sanitize it.
Bourbon is a nice touch, though, I have to admit. But
for
Well, I've done ciders. I haven't dropped any in any mead, but I've done a couple of apple ciders where I have taken the oak and then left them in bourbon for like weeks at a time, and then pulled it out, dumped it and the bourbon into the cider, and came out with something very special. But
yeah, but you already know my history with bourbon, so
yeah. Chris,
I don't do anything that adds a bourbon flavor to anything. Back in college, I spent one night hugging the toilet bowl because of bourbon. So. I haven't had a taste for it since.
Wow. What else is on your mind tonight, Brian? I know you had a couple other things too you wanted to talk
about. Yeah, last thing I had on there was about, you know, y'all were talking about pH in one of your episodes. And have y'all, you know, from the time when you first started out, because I don't have a pH meter yet, but obviously I need to get me one. But, you know, thinking back when you first started and then after you got one and your batches, I mean, was it something that was, you know, hugely noticeable in your changing your batches and keeping them, you know, at the right pH, or was it just kind of a, you know, a nice little polishing finish or something like that?
I can't speak to the taste because it kind of goes beyond that. You know, I suppose, you know, Chris is probably the best. He's kind of our resident scientist, with our resident keeper and judge, but. I don't know that you can actually taste the pH difference, can you, Chris?
No, I think what you may be confusing a total acidity with pH. And while total acidity can affect pH, they're two totally different tests that you would perform. So if you have a pH meter, you're strictly testing the concentration of hydrogen ions, basically. You're testing the pH. And so you need to understand where each one comes into play. And pH is not so much a thing of taste or flavor. pH is more related to the health of the yeast. You want to keep your pH in the proper range in order for your yeast to be able to do what they do without being stressed. So, in some ways, a pH meter is only valuable when something starts to go wrong, because that's when you can use your pH meter, and as long as you're within range, then you don't have to do anything. So that's really all the pH meter does. But if you have something go wrong with a batch and you don't have a pH meter, then you're left scratching your head because you don't have a way to find out. But if you can put that meter in there and say, okay, my pH got too low, I need to bring it up, then you can add some potassium carbonate or whatever. And bring that pH back up into range. Now, as far as flavor is concerned, you would be looking more at something called total acidity. And you'll see it abbreviated on the boards and things as TA. But it's something that winemakers really will do as a finishing touch. Once fermentation is complete, once you go through secondary and you get things cleared out, then you can actually do a total acidity test. And you just buy this little test kit. The problem with that, though, is that now you're just going by numbers. So if you want to avoid all that and you want to avoid buying the test kit, why not just go by taste? You know, I mean, my goodness, taste, if it tastes flabby, if it's flat and flabby and it's just not bright enough, then you probably need to add a little acidity to it. On the other hand, if it's too tart, then you probably need to maybe consider sweetening it up a little bit. So, I prefer to go by flavor rather than try to go by charts and numbers.
I can second that. Chris knows very well. Chris knows very well about
that.
Yeah, that's if you listen to a number of the shows, I've talked about, you know, the big pumpkin failure, but I, you know, like Chris, I have pretty much tossed. I think I kept one little thing of acid blend. because Chris gave me a good idea as far as using it. I use it on my coffee maker, of all things. So, I use that to clean out my Keurig coffee maker. That's the only reason why I keep that little thing of acid blend. I don't put acid in my mead anymore at all, ever.
That's what I wondered.
Yeah, very seldom will you ever need to add acid, especially in mead. Wine, grape wine is a different story. Grape wine has to be adjusted almost with every batch in some direction. Mead, for some reason, at least to my taste anyway, very seldom needs any acid at all. But occasionally you will get a batch that, and it comes out a little bit flatty, or it comes out sort of dark tasting, and you want to brighten it up, and that's where your acid comes in. Maybe another way that you might use it is if you have a batch that ends up way too sweet. If it's just way too sweet, you've either got to blend it with a drier mead, or you can try adding some acid to counterbalance that sweetness. That doesn't always work because you can end up with something that tastes like a sweet tart, and you don't want that. But if it's, you know, if it's within reason, you can try saving it that way. Most of the time, I just prefer, if I get one that's too sweet, just set it aside and, get, you know, make a batch that's dry and blend it. But, yeah, understanding how this acid works is a big deal in mead making, because you're going to find out that honey has this intrinsic acidity to it. And whether your basswood finishes, you'll definitely find out how much acidity honey can have. So you know, understand how it works and what it does, and I think some of that just comes with practice.
I hope we've been able to help you out here tonight,
yeah,
Brian.
Yeah,
we have answered all your questions. Or
yeah, you did a good job. I appreciate the insight and the input, and keep these going. I like listening to them.
We're going to move on here and start talking about beer. One of the things that, you know, we're finding some parallel history with beer and mead. So if you want to stick around, apparently not. He's gone. So, all right, Brian, thanks for calling in tonight. And, you know, our listeners out there that listen after the fact, you don't necessarily have to be live, but hey, if you've got a question, you know, make sure you, you know, get it into us, and we'll do our level best to, you know, find some kind of an answer for you. The contact information on the website, themeadhouse.com, just go to that contact us, fill out the form, and when we get it, we blast it out to Jeff and Aaron and Chris, and hopefully we can come up with an answer for you. But I kind of wanted to move in. Yeah.
While we're talking about callers and everything, I need to give a shout out to Eric Mossick. He emailed me about the heart murmur.
Yeah.
He thought that maybe I had put that on the back burner. he was wondering why I suddenly wasn't talking about it anymore. Eric, I've just had tons of things going on, and I've been so busy. But it still is sitting around, and it turned out pretty good. And we will, when we get this cherry thing laid aside, and I get a chance, I'll try to get the recipe posted for you and everybody else, and maybe we can spend a few minutes on one show in the near future talking about it and
sure,
kind of explaining why it's so complicated and messy.
Yeah. Yeah.
But thanks, Eric, for emailing me, and I'll get you something in the mail pretty soon.
Perfect. We're going to move into we're kind of going to, you know, the show has been all about mead, And I thought that, you know, because beer and mead share a very parallel path all down through history from the very beginning, that, you know, we could start talking about beer a little bit, because at some point, you know, you can come, you know, those paths are going to cross. And there is a style of mead out there called Braggot, which incorporates, you know, much of the even the processes that you go into beer making, as well as the ingredient. So Aaron and I've been wanting to talk to Aaron because he seemed like he was pretty knowledgeable about beer making, at least, you know, has had quite a bit more experience than I did. We talked to each other on the phone the other day for, gosh, probably about an hour and a half, and almost to the overwhelming point, but I did get a lot of information. Aaron, you know, we're beer and mead. What were some of the things that we found very similar in our discussion when it comes to beer and mead?
Well, when you look at the history of the two beverages, I think it's hard to debate that one of the two was probably the first fermented beverage that man made. You know, think back to ancient civilizations that stumbled across some barley grains or some honeybees, and, you know, maybe they learned that was a good food source. And you can think of somebody back in history leaving some of those ingredients out, where maybe they were exposed to some rainwater, and over time, you know, maybe it sat there for a while, and some natural yeasts got in there and did their magic. And then they came back and found this bubbly, delicious liquid that, you know, when they drank it, it kind of made everything a little better. So, you know, I think when you look back through history, beer and mead certainly have parallel paths, like you say, as being the oldest fermented beverages known to man.
When it comes down to ingredients, however, this is kind of where, you know, mead takes one path, beer takes another, because the fermentable sugars in mead, as we all know, is honey. The fermentable sugars in beer come from grains. And, you know, we talked about this idea. Now, we're going to get into this whole Braggot discussion, and this is where Chris and Jeff are going to come into play here. But you and I, because I have this need to want to brew beer. You have the experience of already done that. We talked about some of the ingredients and how they can be used in one or the other or both. Let's talk about the malt aspect here for a minute. That's pretty much the primary sugar source in beer, right?
Correct, yes. So malted barley. So what is malted barley? The barley grain, when it's harvested, what they do to it is they partially germinate it. And once it's partially germinated, they'll dry it. And at that time, it goes through a process where it develops some sugars, some soluble starches, and some enzymes. And those enzymes are key. That's what actually will convert the starches to fermentable sugars, which is what gives the yeast its food.
Yeah. Okay.
So malted barley, it comes in a couple of different forms. I mean, certainly you can just use all grains, and that would be where you would actually be buying malted barley grains. I think that's a little bit more of an advanced beer making technique that I don't have much experience with at all, which leads me to the second form, which would be like a malt extract. And malt extract, it's essentially also comes in two forms, either a syrup or a powder. And what they do is they take the malted barley and they go through a process called mashing. So those enzymes that I was talking about, between 150 degrees and 160 degrees in a water mixture, those enzymes become active, and those long strands of those starches start to get broken down by the enzymes into the fermentable sugars. So after that mashing process, you've got a real sweet liquid, and that is what they actually dehydrate through, like an evaporation process, to either a syrup, which would be about 20% water, or to a powder, which would be just about 0% water. And those are kind of the two forms of malt extract that you can use.
Aaron? And,
yes.
JD doesn't like science. You just ruined it for him.
Aaron and I, we spent this hour and a half talking about this very thing. And, I mean, some of it is okay. I mean, you got to know, you know, what some of these processes are and how do we get to that point. But let's drill it down here. In fact, let's throw it across the table over to Chris. You've done a Braggot in the past, correct?
Yes, Irish Red Ale Braggot.
And how did you incorporate the beer ingredients, the malt or whatever was it that you used?
This was very simple. This was a dry malt extract, and I even hesitate to call it an Irish Red Ale Braggot because the only thing associated with that was the yeast. It was an Irish ale yeast that I used. So, you know, I would like to redo that recipe and this time use an all grain approach and actually make an Irish red ale. But the thing of it is, I'm not set up to do that. And so, you know, maybe one day I can get an Irish ale kit and just use the grains out of it to make the Braggot from.
Yeah. Well,
that's my very limited experience with brewing anything beer related at all.
Well, what was the result? I mean, were you pleased with the result, or I mean, how did it work out? Do you recall?
Yeah, I mean, it was really good, but to be honest, when you consider the added wait time that the honey adds to it, for my taste, I think I would rather just brew a beer.
Yeah.
Honestly, because, you know, the honey really adds an aging aspect to it that takes a while. Okay. It's not like making a good batch of mead. It does take some time for everything to come together in a Braggot. And so I think if I'm going to go the Braggot route, I probably would make a beer on the side just to have to drink.
Well, you know, we were talking about incorporating some of the ingredients into either beer or meat or both. But let's get specific. How about incorporating them into a mead? We were talking about using, Jeff, 50% honey and 50% malt extract. That gets us into the category, correct? Because at least 50% of the fermentables have to come from honey.
Yeah, that's, and really, the more I think about it, I think the at least the majority of the fermentables have to come from honey. So if, for example, you were doing something with a Braggot with a little bit of a fruit flavor as well, maybe you have something in the neighborhood of, you know, 40% honey, 35% malt, and whatever the remainder is that 20% fruit. I think that's still a Braggot because the majority is still honey.
Yeah. But is that up until, I mean, you know, we're not necessarily doing this for competition. So perhaps the amounts really don't make that much difference. But I mean, if folks out there want to do this for competition, they have to be very aware in order to qualify for that particular category. But
I would have to look at how the BJCP categorizes that. Yeah, at some point, if your malt is stronger than your honey, then you're making a beer flavor with honey. Yeah. For our listeners that are just making stuff at home for their own and their friends and family's enjoyment, I don't think it matters much. No.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the process here for a minute. In beer, as I discovered, there's this whole big, long boiling process that you have to go through. I assume that's the case with building a braggot as well, correct?
I would think so. I mean, you need to. There are the malt extracts and things like that. That really the malt extract does kind of pour a lot like honey.
Yeah.
If you're going to incorporate hops, I would think you need to boil those for a while. And typically, when you're making a beer, you boil that malt extract and the hops together. I'm not sure if anybody's tried to do it without a boil.
Well, guess what? This is we're going down a path here that I am going to explore here in my own kitchen, in my own mead lab, because we had talked about Aaron and I had talked about we talked about the method, we talked about ingredients, and then we talked about how would we incorporate this whole thing into a beverage. And so here's my take, okay? The boil is really insignificant except for the hops, because it's my understanding that the extract doesn't necessarily have to be boiled. It just needs to be heated up to a temperature that would allow it to be mixed in, with the water sufficiently, correct?
Well,
is there any reason? I mean, in our discussion, Aaron, we didn't come up with a reason why the extract itself had to be boiled. It was more along the lines of the hops that needed to be boiled.
That is the main reason for the boil is, the acids that are present in the hop flower that give the beer the bitter flavor need to be boiled so that they kind of mix into the wort. I've actually heard too, and this isn't something I've ever used or have experience with, but have read about hopped malt extract where the extract comes pre-hopped, so to speak, and I think some of those even market themselves as being a no-boil extract.
Yeah, which might be something that I'd have to look into. Because one of the things that we were not really having any difficulty with, but one of the comments that we were making was, how to put the process together. Do we, is it boil or no boil? Now here's the thing, Chris. When you heat honey up, it's pretty much a done deal. You're going to lose the character, aromas. You're pretty much. You might as well just pour a pound of sugar into a pot of boiling water at that point, right?
Yeah, almost. Maybe not exactly, but when I did mine, I did a 60-minute boil with the malt extract and the hops, and I used three different kinds of hops. I used East Kent Goldings. I would have to look back at my notes now. I can't remember. Cascade, I think. And some other kind. Anyway, three different kinds of hops. But I did the boil because of the hops. And then once the boil was over, I let it cool down to still fairly warm. And then I added in the honey. And I did it at that point just so it would be easy to dissolve.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't boil the honey at all, and I don't see any reason to.
Well, Yeah, that was kind of my point in talking with Aaron, that, you know, that the malt and the honey could be mixed together after the fact. But then how do what do you do with the hops? Now, back over to Jeff. I mean, what's to prevent, and I'm asking you because you're big on making these and using these, these herbs and things in your meads. Mm-hmm. What's to prevent you from just getting your hops, putting them in a small pot of water, doing your 60-minute boil, and then, dropping the aroma hops in the last couple of minutes, and then pouring that tea into your mix?
Well, actually, that's exactly how I make my hop mead.
Perfect.
I do that. I let it cool to below 95 because I'm using raw honey and I don't want to lose any of the those little sensitive aromatics. Yeah. But at that point, it's nice and warm, so it does blend the honey easy. If you've got that all the boil you need, really, I don't do a full boil with my hop mead. I do about 5 to 10 minutes. I've done it once. At 60 minutes, I've done it once at 10 minutes. And I got about the same effect for it. So there may be some differences in there that I'm not noticing off the top of my head, but I was pleased with both results. So I went for the shorter time for future reference.
Let's make the distinction between a hopped mead and a braggot also. I mean, yes. That's you can definitely do a hopped mead without calling it a braggot because without malt. So... Mm-hmm. Don't confuse the two.
Well, right. And if you are just going to use an extract syrup, you may not need to incorporate that into a boil at all. The one thing I would caution, though, with regards to the syrups and stuff, I think Aaron mentioned there is a hopped extract, and the only thing I would say against using that is that you're kind of in. Your ability to choose the level and the type of hops go into it have been taken away from you by using that. You're kind of at the mercy of the extract makers to say, this is how much hops I want. This is the kind of hop flavor I want. So that, while convenient, might not be the best course of action for every braggot maker out there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, having never had a braggot, I have no idea what to expect. I have no idea what it tastes like or supposed to taste like or anything. Difficult, if any, at best to even find out here where I'm at. I'll just have to go back to my Total Wine and start applying the same pressure I did to get more meat on the shelf there as I,
JD, I'll send you my recipe. Did I send it to Jeff and Aaron, one of you guys or both of you?
I think we may have exchanged some braggot recipes maybe a month or two ago.
Yeah, but the one that I did, it's about as simple as you can get when it comes to making a braggot. It does have a 60-minute boil, but... and then you just put it on the boil and add in some hops as you go along.
Chris, you mentioned that it took an incredibly long time for the flavors to come together in the aging process. Any particular reason why?
It was drinkable within the time frame that a beer would be drinkable. But I didn't really enjoy it until after about 6 months. Yeah. There was something about the flavors that just really, they just really came together and things started to come out that just wasn't there within the first couple of months. Even a traditional mead, that if you do everything right, is drinkable and enjoyable long before that was. And certainly a beer, what's the average? I mean, you guys, y'all know more about beer than I do, but it's anywhere from 4 to 7 weeks on average.
Yeah.
something like that to drink a beer. And this was a good 6 months before the flavors just really started to shine like I thought they should. But you know, it's certainly drinkable before then. So you know, I guess it's just whatever you're looking for will determine when you drink it.
I'll second that. The Porter Boucher that I've mentioned a couple times here was, for the longest time, it was an act of faith, because I swear the first 11 months or so it was sitting in a carboy, like just aging properly, nigh on undrinkable. And it finally, at 11 months, I was like, yeah, this is okay. This is pretty good. Now it's getting close to about 2 years old, and it is beautiful. It is really coming to its own. For whatever reason, Braggots just seem to take a little while to really get their stride.
Yeah.
Now, I will say, in my experience with, and I've done, I think, one Braggot recipe a couple of times, and I've had the opposite, where I've actually found I enjoyed it more when it was fresher, you know, maybe a couple of months old. It's not to say that it deteriorated or became bad or anything over time, but it just started to develop some flavors that I didn't just personally find as appealing over time. So it's, yeah, very interesting. And another interesting thing about it too is this is a pretty high gravity Braggot recipe. It actually calls for 9 pounds of wildflower honey and then 6 pounds of a light malt extract with an original gravity of 1.110. And if anything, I would think, you know, the higher gravity Braggot recipe, and it also calls for D47 yeast, believe it or not. You know, just looking at that recipe, I would think that that would be one that would take some aging time to really shine. But it's really good early.
Those fermentables are not that far off from the one that I made. As far as the amounts, I had 6 pounds of malt extract, and I think it was 8 or 9 pounds of honey also. So they're not that far off. But I think maybe it's the flavor of the hops, maybe the kind of hops and how much. Because I loaded the thing up. Now this was, I think it was, gosh, it was at like 70 IBUs or higher. I can't remember. It was a lot.
That's pretty high, yeah.
Yeah, but and some of them were, the last ones were for aroma, and some were for bittering, and some were just for flavor.
Yeah.
Of course, with the East Kent Goldings, you know, some people might say, well, you went more toward an English ale than an Irish red ale. And maybe I did, I don't know, which I'm not really a big fan of English ales. But I don't know, it turned out good. It just took a long time to really come into where I thought it should be. I got a question for Jeff and Aaron both. On the Braggots you've made, did you carbonate them or did you leave them still?
I have carbonated both mine.
Well, mine stayed still. I took mine to the alcohol tolerance of the yeast, so there was, without a keg or anything, I had no option to carbonate.
Mm-hmm.
Gotcha.
Because I left mine still, and I always wondered what it would have been like if I had carbonated it.
I very much this Porter Braggot, because it's so dark and it has so many, it has like a kind of a Guinness-like flavor. I've thought about getting myself a kegging system and a tank of nitro to see what it would do with a nice, like, really silky nitrogen head to it, but I've not had the opportunity to do that yet.
What the flavor wise, Chris, is it sweet, semi sweet, dry? I mean, how would you describe it?
No, it was dry. To my taste, it was dry. and it was somewhat bitter. If you've ever had an Irish red ale, that's pretty much what it was, with a good dose of an earthy honey character to it. Mm-hmm. And it's unlike anything else. I mean, it's a totally, it's a drink of its own. It's a flavor of its own, and it's really hard to describe. But, you know, it's a good mix. I mean, I would say that it's a good mix of mead and beer. It really is just that. And,
well, that's what I'm looking to do. You know, I'm not quite ready to put the recipe together yet. I think we need a couple of more shows to talk about it. But I like the fact that we can come together and talk about the processes and the experiences. Well, that's kind of what this show's all about anyway. And if anybody out there listening to the show, you know, if you've got experience building braggots, working with beer, then, you know, here's the thing I'm finding, too. Everywhere I go out there, the couple of forums that are most popular out there, one in particular, there's a lot of beer brewers who are now brewing mead and vice versa. So, I mean, you know, as much as they share a historical common path, you know, even when you get down to home brewing, you know, you would think mead makers would turn to wine, but most of them don't. They're usually beer brewers. So funny how that worked out. But
I think a lot of beer brewers, I think they tend to go over to mead because they see it as, oh, wait a minute. I can, in a matter of 30 or 45 minutes, I can put some stuff in a bucket and I can make it. And they think, you know, well, this is like the easy way out, but then it doesn't turn out so well. And suddenly you realize that there's more to making mead than just throwing some stuff in a bucket.
Oh, yeah, by all means. I mean, the process of putting your recipe together is much shorter when it comes to mead. However, I think the maintenance of it and the management of it is probably a lot more hands-on than it is in beer making. That's what I'm finding out realistically with my...
Yeah, absolutely. You're not going to save time by switching over to mead from beer. You may save some time on brew day, but in the long run, you're going to put just as much effort, if not more, in a batch of mead that you do in beer.
I have a brown porter that is in one of my fermenters right now. This is my second batch of beer that I'm making for my wife. She loves stouts and porters. This one is a kind of a chocolate porter. It had a thing of, I dumped the package out. Some kind of chocolate grain or I don't know what the hell it was, but like 8 ounces of this stuff that I had to put in a little sock and, you know, steep it for an hour. On top of that, at the last probably 2 minutes of the boil, I dumped in, I think it was an ounce or an ounce and a half of just dry cocoa powder. So it's in the fermenter now, but you have no idea how close I came to just dumping in like, oh, let's put like 12 pounds of honey in it. You know, I wanted to do that so bad. And I thought, you know what? No, wait. I need to explore this more. And that's the whole purpose of getting involved in, you know, like I said, beer and mead. I mean, they're similar in history. But here's the deal. I don't want a sweet drink. I mean, y'all know me and sweet drinks. I just, it's not that I detest them. I don't care for them. I want this to be almost beer-like, but I want the characteristics that the honey can bring forth. And this is why, you know, in my discussion with Aaron, you know, we were talking about the whole process, boil or no boil. And, you know, Jeff, I like the idea of making the tea out of the hops. Not quite sure you know, I mean, does it matter how much water that you boil them in? Or I suppose it doesn't, but and then of course the what kind of hops to use. I don't understand a lot about the flavors that hops, you know, bring forth. Mm-hmm. Now I do have to say that I like a hoppy beer, not overly hopped, but I like tasting the different components in a good beer. I mean, if you're going to, you know, these craft breweries, they painstakingly put these recipes together. And if you've never had a craft beer before, try one, because it's like drinking beer for the first time. This is what it's supposed to taste like, not the other labeled stuff. So
really, you need to try like six different varieties of six very different craft beers to see that there is a wide breadth of different beer styles and beer flavors available. Even the same type of beer has a lot of different components and different things that different brewers will do with it. Let alone, there have to be in the neighborhood of, you know, almost 100 different varieties of beer out there that people are playing with and doing different things with and innovating with. So it's a renaissance of craft beer right now.
Yeah. Well, and I've even read recipes where people have dumped entire chocolate cakes into their boil. I mean, the cake frosting, everything. Just slide it off the cake pan right into the boil. So, you know.
If you go to the craft beer store here, when we have several around close, it's like going in there and it's all the weird things that we talk about with mead. They're doing the same thing with beer.
Yeah.
I mean, they've got raspberry beers, they've got juniper berry and and lemon zest beers, and you know, all the crazy stuff that we come up with to do with mead, they're doing it with beer. So
And I think that's the fun thing about this whole hobby, this whole home brewing thing, you know, is the fact that you can come up with your own variation on a flavor or profile or whatever. I mean, if you like chocolate cake, then why not dump a chocolate cake into the mix? Who's to tell what it's going to taste like when it comes out? It might be damn good. You know, you might find yourself hugging the toilet after the first bottle. You never know. You know, Chris and his bourbon, you know, and I mean, even bourbon, for crying out loud, there's even bourbon barrel oaked beers out there that I have seen on the shelf. So go figure, you know.
Yep. All the same things that you see and hear and discuss about mead, you will probably find it in a beer.
Yeah. Well, I think the next step here is to talk about the different aspects of the flavoring compounds, like the different grain. I would probably have to depend on Aaron and Jeff for a little input on that. You know, when we get to that point, maybe we can talk a little bit about that on the next show. And the hops. You know, I mean, what exactly, what do the hops bring to beer, and how do they, and to mead for that point? You know, I mean, I get the bittering part. I'm not so sure I understand the 60-minute part. I mean, is that the bitter, or does the bitter come from the stuff you add at the end? And they talk about this aroma thing. What am I supposed to be smelling anyway? You know.
Well, to give you a quick teaser on this, the longer boil parts are for the alpha acids. That's the bittering component. The stuff you add towards the end of the boil is either a flavor component other than just bitterness, or it's an aroma component. And you know, usually when you talk about aromas, you get a little bit of that same bitter perception with your aroma, but you'll get some floral hints. You might get some pine or some citrus. It really depends on the style of hops you chose.
Yeah. I know my pumpkin beer smells like pumpkin. I mean, if the cans of pumpkin that I put in had any effect on the beer at all, it would be that it smells like pumpkin, you know. But that being said, I kind of know what's going on. I mean, you know, you can't pull the wool over JD's eyes. That pumpkin smell I smell, that's coming from the pumpkin spice. I know it's cinnamon and ginger and, you know, nutmeg and all these common pumpkin pie spices smell like. So I'm not sold on the pumpkin thing. So the pumpkin's going to go back on the back burner for now until I come up with something. But, you know.
This wasn't a failure like your first pumpkin.
No, not at all. No, in fact, I'm drinking this one tonight. I've had two of them today. And I, you know, and Chris, some of the things that I've read about making beer. Now, here's what I do know about beer, okay? Beer is not meant to age, okay? When you buy beer in the liquor store, you need to consume it within weeks or several months, not 6 months, 8 months, a year, because beer isn't there a danger there because of a low alcohol in beer and bacteria?
Well, I don't know exactly what the components are that would go bad, but I can tell you that beer is very susceptible to a reductive odor. If you've ever heard people talk about skunky beer, yes, that's exactly what it is. It's a reductive quality that's coming through. Of course, this thing is full of CO2 and nitrogen. It's completely purged of all oxygen. It's usually capped, sometimes even with oxygen absorbing caps, so you're not getting any oxygen whatsoever as you would in a wine or a mead that has a cork in it that allows micro oxidation to occur. So naturally, if you're going to go one way or the other, it's going to go toward the reductive side. And that's where the sort of the rotten cabbage, skunky type flavors and aromas come from. But I will say there is an exception to what you said, and I only know this because of looking through different recipes and things. There are some higher gravity beers that are aged quite a long time before they're bottled, but I think once they're bottled, it's a different story. I'm not sure about that.
Yeah, that's my understanding too. Is once they're bottled, they need to be drunk in a reasonable amount of time. It's not like, you know, some wines where you can leave them sit for several years. You know,
right.
That's not the case. But and so here we go back to the mead again. You know, I think I want something that's more beer like. I don't want something that's more mead like. I don't want a 12 or 13 or 14% beer. I want maybe a 6, you know, a little higher gravity beer, 6, 7%, maybe 8% would be tops in a beer braggot, braggot mead, however you want to put it. Because I definitely want, here's the other bottom line, okay? If you're going to dump honey into it, that, you know, I mean, the honey is probably the most expensive component, you know, and we've talked about it before in making mead. If you're going to put, you know, a significant amount of honey into it, you want to at least get what that honey, the character, the aroma, whatever contributions that honey is going to make, right? I mean, other than, you know, beyond that, just make beer.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
Well, I'm just thinking off the top of my head here. I mean, it's just, you know.
You know, as I said, with my experience, which is I've made one braggot and I've made it twice, and that's my full experience with braggots and beer at all. But from those two experiences, I say either make it with the intentions of waiting until it's ready, which could be 6 months to 2 years or whatever, or just make meat or beer, yeah. One or the other. I'm not opposed to making brackets at all. It's just that I guess they're just not my favorite thing because of the time that it takes. You know, I'm impatient, so I like to get things in a bottle.
That coming from a doctor.
Yeah.
Well, you know, just one thought I'm having here to throw out there to the listeners. I will say, you know, making beer is very easy. I think a lot of the equipment that you have as a mead maker translates to the equipment that you would need from a beer brewing perspective. There may be a couple things here and there extra that you would need to pick up. I am very interested kind of where this conversation is going with JD, where we're talking about the, you know, the traditional stovetop home brewing of beer process, which is pretty easy. It's very easy to make delicious, good quality beer at home, and kind of adapting that to the braggot. So definitely excited to see where we go with this.
You know, Aaron, the only, and I already had it because of my tomato sauce making deal that I do in every September, but the only additional piece of equipment, if you're a mead maker, is basically a large stock pot. And I mean a large stock pot, something 23 quarts or better, that, you know, you can hold. Now, you know, when they talk about 2.5-3 gallons, that means about 3/4 of the way full, 2.5 to 3 gallons, because there are, you know, I don't want to get into the whole process of making beer, but there is a part of beer making that could be extremely disastrous on the stove if you're not very careful when you add things like hops and malt extracts and whatnot. But that's basically the only extra piece of equipment outside of my whole mead making arena here that I can think of, you know. And like you said, you've got the rest of it. You know, if you've got a vessel to ferment in, something to rack to when the ferment's done,
not good to go.
A lot more, yeah. You know,
that may be a huge funnel.
Well, yeah. You know, I mean, I kind of have one up on a lot of people because of my little setup I've got here. I'm able to ferment in, you know, nice, huge, big stainless steel fermenters. You know, the only critical thing that I would add to it is temperature control. It can affect how good your beer comes out. If you have no way of controlling temperature, even if it's putting it downstairs in a basement that's 65 degrees, if you have nothing more than the kitchen floor that, you know, might be 70 degrees, you might want to think more about, you know, some ability to cool it down. Go into the, you know, DIY stuff that, you know, Chris and I have been talking about, you know, with methods of cooling your wort or cooling your fermentation down. So, but other than that, I'm not quite so sure what kept me from, I thought beer making was this big, complicated, I mean, people talking about hops and boils and add this at 15 minutes, add that at 1 minute, and all this stuff. And I'm shocked at how simple this process is, really.
100%.
Yeah, and I'm gonna really go with heavy on the temperature control, and I've been doing this since the first time that JD and I ever talked. The first time, I mean, way back on the other podcast.
Yeah.
And I've said it, and I'm gonna keep saying it until people finally realize. I think he means that. you know, if somebody walked up to me today and said, I want to start making mead, what's the first thing I should do? I would say, get some sort of temperature control. Don't buy honey, don't buy yeast, don't buy a fermentation bucket, don't buy anything else until you buy some sort of way to control your temperature. And when you get that, come back and then we'll talk about what you need to do to start making mead.
Exactly.
That's how important this is.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I'm more and more so when it comes to beer making. Fermentation temperatures in beer making are very critical, especially when you get into making lagers. You know, if you've got nothing more than a stovetop and a cooler full of ice to, you know, to manage your fermentation in, don't make lagers because it's not going to work. You need to be at temperatures of around 45 degrees to 50 degrees to make lagers. So, you know, man, lager happens to be my favorite kind of beer. So, you know, so much looking forward to you know, putting a lager beer together. And when it, you know, all the reading that I've done about temperature control, that's out because I can't get my controllers. I'll never be able to get with any degree of certainty. So, but hey, we're running out of time here. We got a lot more to talk about in future shows about this whole beer mead thing, Braggots. And Chris, you might as well get your stuff ready because here in about, you know, maybe a month or so, you're going to be putting another Braggot together, one that we're going to put together here on the show. Between, you know, over the next...
Do I have to do it live again, or can we make Aaron and Jeff do it this time? Because that was a job. I almost dropped my phone in the fermenter.
Yeah.
And I spent 30 minutes cleaning sticky honey off my phone after that.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, we'll make Jeff and Aaron do that. But over the next couple of weeks, let's do some homework, guys. I really want to know more about hops and extracts and grains as well. You know, what little I know right now, I'm not confident about putting a recipe together with any degree of certainty that it's going to actually work. So let's try to knuckle down, get a little homework in, rely on our experiences and everything that we've already got. But right now, let's go through the hopper list. I'll start it off tonight. I talked about it already. I've got the porter. And actually, when this chocolate porter thing gets done fermenting, when it comes out of the fermenter, it's going to go into a carboy just for about 18 hours on about 4 ounces of whole coffee beans. And then it's going to come right off and go into another clean carboy where it will finish its thing, you know, until I'm ready to bottle. So that's happening right now in the fermenter. I just racked a nice red table wine from Wine Experts called Mezzaluna. Looking forward to that. As far as meads go, in the bucket, fermenting now as we speak. As a matter of fact, I think we talked about it on the last show, the peach mead. Mississippi wasn't with us, but I did speak with him between then and tonight. So he's well aware. And the peaches, it's basically 20 pounds of peaches that sat for 4 days on Lauzyme EX and Lauzyme EX, or no, Lauzyme C-Max. Came out to 2 grams each of both of those chemicals. And they sat for 4 days, along with a couple of Camden tablets. Is actually measured out as potassium. I got to get this right. Potassium metabisulfite. And then that last day, the lid came off. It was stirred vigorously for, you know, over the course of, you know, until I went to bed, every couple of hours, stirred vigorously. and just with a towel draped over to exhaust those gases from the metal bisulfite. Also 5 pounds of nectarines. I forgot to mention that. Now, I mashed it all up with the potato, or you know, with a giant potato masher that I have, you know, when I added all the chemicals. So it was pretty much in a just a mess. It was a mess. Chris, you're right. It's a mess. You were right about sticky mess, just mess. It's a mess. So it gave me roughly 2 gallons, about just a shade over 2 gallons of pulp liquid. That was all dumped into a big bucket with my strainer bag, my fruit bag, so I could capture all of the pulp. And then it was redumped back into my fermenting pail. And 71B added. I don't remember how much honey I rarely measure honey anymore. I just put what I think is enough in, and I get the hydrometer out. So we started out at 1.120. Hopefully this is going to go in the neighborhood of semi-dry, semi-sweet, semi, whatever you want to put it. So that's in the fermenter right now. So, but other than that, let's throw it over to Chris. What you got on the hopper list, bud?
Well, normally I would have everything full at this time of year, but I've been so busy, I'm so far behind right now. The only thing I've got going is the cherry sitting on the chocolate and mullet. Everything else is in aging vessels and set aside, and some of it's ready to bottle. I've still got the little chocolate orange and the chocolate strawberry. I've still got several coffees that need to be bottled. I've still got the heart murmur sitting aside, the aging, and it's ready for bottles. It just hadn't got around to it yet.
Yeah.
As far as what's coming up, I'm going to do my sourwood. And I asked Jeff and Aaron a while back what they liked, and they sent me some suggestions. So I'm going to get a batch going, something that I can mail to them. And that's about it for now. I've got to do all my regulars here pretty soon. Got to do a regular cherry and a couple more traditionals, and probably do a ginger mead that I always do every year. And then probably by that time it's going to be getting into apple season, and mm-hmm. we'll be ready to do some episodes on sizers.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I just, you know, I still have, everybody knows I've got a whole lot more than what I just told you about, but I mean, I got the sourwood going, a lot of stuff just sitting back aging. The Boucher I made a while back, I got to be honest with you guys, wasn't real thrilled with the flavor. That being said, it's been sitting in a carboy now for a better part of a month, and it's starting to come around a little bit. So I'm hoping that that's going to play out and be okay. I'm just going to leave it sit. And then, of course, the coffee thing, that's just sitting right now, too, kind of on the back burner. But, Aaron, what's on the hopper list, bud?
So I'm kind of at this stage as some of you guys, it sounds like, where I've got the fermenters full of aging mead. Not too much change. Got the 3 hopped meads that are getting pretty darn clear, probably close to getting those bottled. The coffee Boucher mead, that still has a ways to go, still pretty cloudy. And then also this wildflower traditional that I'm sitting on. It's definitely starting to show some signs of clarifying. I'm not quite ready with that one yet, but getting close.
Perfect. Jeff, what's your hopper list looking like?
Well, I've got a lot in bulk aging at the moment. I've got a bunch of stuff on deck, but I don't really have a lot of stuff going on immediately here. The Chirimoya is, it's seeming more and more like a lost cause. And then I've got the hop mead that I made that was overhopped, and it needs to be blended out with something a little on the dry side, I think, just to cut that hop flavor a little bit and make it a little bit more palatable. And then I've got the coffee mead, and I was chagrined to learn that the place that I had bought my East Timor coffee beans from no longer carries the East Timor blend. So I'm either going to have to blend it with some other type of coffee, or I'm going to have to try coffee with something else and just leave this as the as coffee as it's going to get. And I'm kind of debating on that as well, because there is a little bit of a hot estuary flavor in it that I'm not crazy about either. So I may just do that.
Honestly, I'm over the coffee.
Yeah. I think we played that one out. Go ahead, Jeff.
Well, yeah, my longstanding promise to myself was that I was going to get some experience done with Melomels this year. So I've got some big freezer bags sitting around with apricots, with plums, with nectarines, with mulberries. Added some Concord grapes that a woman I work with gave me, and what else? Probably some blackberries will wind up in a mead at some point or another too. A lot on the hop, on deck, but nothing quite working in there yet.
Okay, well, cool. Sounds good. Yeah, I'm pretty much done with the coffee thing, and I think Sergio just might have something. You know what? Just make a traditional, pour some coffee into it until you like it, and then drink that.
Yeah, I'm pretty much over the coffee. I was really excited about it. I mean, I was really hopped up about it. And, you know, I'm over it now. It's just not my thing.
Yeah, me neither. It just didn't go in the direction that I was hoping would go in. But I think a lot of that happens to fall back on how you enjoy your coffee. I assume that people who, like my wife, who drinks, has a little bit of coffee with her sugar and cream, she might enjoy something, you know, a sweet coffee mead. But that's not quite, how I like my coffee. I like it rich and black and straight up, as a lot of people say, and just, I don't know, just not working in a mead for me. So,
but this is how you get your favorites list. You know, eventually you're going to have a list of recipes that you're going to make over and over and over, and all the rest get tossed, and you don't know until you do what we did on this show. You try all different kinds of things, and finally you either say this is a keeper or I'm over it, let's move on.
Well, that's, you know, we said it from the beginning of the show. I mean, if you don't experiment and try things out, you're never going to know. So, and that's kind of the fun part of doing this whole thing, being able to sit back, do these experiments, and hey, if it doesn't work, it doesn't work.
We haven't tasted each other's either, so no. We can't really count it out yet, because
right.
Jeff and Aaron, they may have a winner, and we just don't know it yet. So
yeah, I mean, by God, we've got the third world's best mead maker in the world, who happens to also be a certified bona fide judge as well. So. And master beekeeper. So, I mean, gosh, when you put all that together.
He's got to be able to make a coffee mead. Come on.
Right. It's not like this is hard or
anything. Yeah. Right. My God.
All right. Well, hey, that's going to do it for tonight. Come on back next Tuesday night, 9 o'clock, right here. Mississippi Chris in the house. Aaron Martin, Jeff Shouse, J.D. Webb. we'll entertain you again. So with that, we'll see everybody next week, 9 o'clock, right here at the Meat House.